I'm not sure, but I want to ask you guys a question. How many of you have student loans or benefited from the student loan debt relief announcement by the Biden administration? How many of you have student loans or are maybe still grappling with them and things like that, and we're relieved to see the student loan debt relief kind of take place? Give me a yes in the chat if you are still dealing with student loans. A lot of people still are. I know people in their 60s that are still paying their student loans. For many people, it becomes a life debt. And I wanted to start off kind of talking about student loans today, because that was kind of one of the first things that was on my mind. Because I read in Inside Higher Ed that that this is apparently not a given thing, that there are lots of states in or Republican districts that are actually trying to challenge student loans. They're trying to reverse the forgiveness. For some reason, they're appalled and offended by the idea of forgiving, what isn't really a lot of money in terms of student loans. It's just $10,000, which is, a drop in the bucket for some people. But they're really freaking out about it. And I'm going to read some of this to you, and then we'll kind of move on. And I'm going to kind of give you the reason I'm bringing it up also is because I want to kind of quickly address what student loans sort of do in terms of shaping the trajectory of Black wealth. In fact, right now I'm actually not talking to you guys from my house. I'm actually speaking to you from Black Wall Street. I'm actually in Tulsa, Oklahoma right now. And I went to do a tour on Black Wall Street, and there was this guy that gave a great tour. His name was Cody. And Cody was telling us all about the area. And it's really kind of sad. If you go to Black Wall Street, you'll find it's sad because, and I recommend everybody do that tour, because what they do is they highlight the difference between, that Greenwood section of Oklahoma today versus what it was 100 years ago. 100 years ago, it was booming. It was amazing. The number of businesses they had in that area was insane. O.W. Gurley, who was one of the architects of the original Black Wall Street, just did an amazing job of really fostering a culture of entrepreneurship in that area. He created his own economy. And I've trained you guys on this, the three C's of creating an economy. I'm gonna do a one-day lecture on this again. All the students that are in the class, I'll invite you guys in for free. But basically, it's the three C's of creating an economy: a market for capital, a market for contractors, and a market for customers. Economies are all about creating markets. So O.W. Gurley was really smart because what he did was he went and he bought a bunch of land, and then he had these buildings built on the land, and he told all the business owners, you can have one of the buildings, but the requirement is that you have to put another business inside your building. And somebody else must benefit from what you have. Right? So this is beautiful because this is a nice mixture between capitalism and socialism, or socialized capitalism, or capitalized socialism, whatever you want to call it. And I love it. It's almost like, people make you pick extremes, one or the other. I don't believe in picking one or the other. I think that there are merits to socialist, communist, Marxist ideas. There are also merits to capitalist ideas. You cannot build a nation if you don't have money. You cannot build a nation with a strong economic infrastructure. You just can't do it. You cannot obtain freedom if economics is not part of your vocabulary. So that's just a fact. That's just true. And I hope you do believe me when I tell you this. So O.W. Gurley, when he was building Black Wall Street, how many of you have even heard of him? Give me a yes or no if you've ever heard of him. I want to know how many of you. I'm just curious right now. Give me a yes in the chat if you know who O.W. Gurley is or have heard his name. It's okay if you haven't. If the answer is no, that's okay. I just want to see, okay, I see some yeses and I see some no's. Okay, Marion and Janet. Okay, Sharon says yes. Okay. All right, so here's what I want you to promise me. Give me a yes in the chat if you can make this commitment to me today. To us, not to me. You're making it to the community. Promise me that you're going to talk about this man to people in your family, that at some point, in the future, in the near future, you're going to talk to your kids about him. You're going to talk to your spouse, your cousin, your baby mama, your best friend, the lady at the hairdresser, whoever, right? Give me a yes to let me know you're going to talk, and this is what's important, because when I was doing this tour of Black Wall Street, it's almost like going to a Mecca for me, almost like if I was Muslim and I was going back, going back to Mecca, right? Or whatever, right? I felt like, okay, I really feel the spirit of these people. And I'm walking down these streets that looks like are just any old hood, and they're showing me images of what that place used to be. It's so sad. I can feel their spirits all throughout that area. And so one of the things O.W. Gurley did that I thought was brilliant and beautiful was he fostered a culture of entrepreneurship. He fostered a culture of black business ownership. If he just went out and bought a bunch of land and just kind of did a couple of things, it wouldn't have grown into what it was. It grew because he planted the seeds and he watered those flowers in a really beautiful way. He also set he set the standard. He set the culture in that area to say, we take care of each other. We're going to help each other build businesses. We're going to create entrepreneurship. Our kids will be taught to be self-sufficient. So as a result, what happened was in Black Wall Street, you had over 100 and something businesses. You had businesses that don't even exist in most black neighborhoods today. You had I'm talking about the bus company. I'm talking about a movie theater. I'm talking about skating rinks. 21 grocery stores. 20. I was blown away. I said, how the hell do you have 21 grocery stores in such a small area? They must have been competing with each other. 21 grocery stores. Do you know that the Greenwood section of Tulsa, Oklahoma, just now got one grocery store after like waiting for about 40 years? Did y'all know that? That they literally just got their first grocery store after decades. They couldn't even get one grocery store now, but they had 21 grocery stores 100 years ago. Doctor's offices, law offices, hotels, you name it, candy shops, whatever, shoe shops, whatever type of business you could think of, they had it all in the Greenwood section of Oklahoma. Now, why? So O.W. Gurley is an important person for us to learn about for this other reason. We had a conversation. I promise you, I'm going to get to the student loan thing in a second, but I had to kind of talk about the Black Wall Street thing. It reminded me. It circles back to how the university, or how I think it's the University of Tulsa or Tulsa University, whatever it's called, was able to capitalize off of black economic disorganization. They were able to benefit from black economic disorganization. And let me tell you how this, I promise you, this links to the student loan conversation, but I gotta tell you the whole backdrop, okay? So I'm going through Black Wall Street, and they're telling me how O.W. Gurley basically created a culture that led to literally hundreds of businesses being in that area. And all this economic independence. And this is a reminder to all of you that when you're talking about economic independence, economic strength, entrepreneurship, business development, it's not just about how many classes you take. It's not just about how much money somebody gives you. It is about culture. It is about your economic habits. These people formed a culture and a set of habits that were built around black economic strength, economic development. They had the habit of spending with each other. They had the habit of educating their own children. They weren't sitting around debating as to whether or not white people were going to give their ch kids a good education, because they would just go talk to other black people and make sure that their kids got a good education. They also made sure their kids got a good education on what it took to sustain that community. This community, a lot of people don't know this about Black Wall Street too. It wasn't like white people just came in there and just took over and killed everybody instantly. They were actually winning that battle. I didn't know this. According to the tour guide, he said they were winning. He said, because in that community, check this out, pay attention, they had lots and hundreds of well-trained, heavily armed, masculine males who had come back from the military. A lot of military men had settled in Oklahoma. And it's because they had all these military men who were ready to fight, who were trained to fight, they were better trained than the white boys across town. Like, did y'all know? How many of y'all knew that? How many of y'all knew that? How many of y'all? A lot of y'all probably thought we just sat there like little sheep. We just slaughtered to death. No, these men were defending that community. They picked up their guns and they said, "You ain't coming over here doing all that." What turned the tables in this battle was when they went and got airplanes and started dropping bombs on the people in the town. Then it was hard to fight against that. They didn't have, I guess, the response to that. They didn't expect that. The bombs is what changed the tune of everything. That's why you see all the burned down buildings and everything else. But the black men in that community were defending that community. So what I really need, the reason I need you to commit to me that you're going to go teach your children about O.W. Gurley, is because this is what our kids need to know. Your public school system is never going to properly teach black children about men like O.W. Gurley. They're just not going to do it. It's not their job. It's not even in their interest to do so. He taught them all about self-sufficiency. He taught them all about self-defense. He taught them all about developing a strong economic culture that is going to lead to black economic strength. There is no reason, if I'm a white teacher in a public school system today, there is no reason on this planet I would ever take the time to want to teach black children about somebody like O.W. Gurley. So what I'm saying to you is that that is your job. That is your job. If you don't feel comfortable, that's okay. Just bring them to me. Bring them to me. I talked to the tour guide. His name was Cody. And I asked Cody, I said, Cody, I want to bring you into the Black Business School because I need people to hear the real story of Black Wall Street. He talked about how a lot of movies got it wrong, how a lot of people made films and didn't give anything back to the community. And I felt kind of bad because we made a movie called Resurrecting Black Wall Street. And it didn't make a ton of money, but we didn't do everything we were supposed to do. So I was kind of paying my own reparations for that. But anyway, long story short, I'm going to bring him in because I need y'all to hear what I heard. It was that powerful, that overwhelming, that surprising. There were a lot of things, like there were little facts that nobody knows. Like, for example, the fact that it wasn't, a lot of people felt that the Black Wall Street got burned down because a white woman accused a black man of touching her inappropriately on the elevator. His name was Dick Rowland and her name was Sarah Page. Well, according to the tour guide, he said, actually, she never said that he did anything to her. She said, no, he did not touch me. It was actually a white man who was a Klansman who saw the two together and too close to each other in what looked like an intimate fashion, where he reported that as an assault. And there's even a discussion that maybe that this guy, Dick Rowland, married Sarah Page because they both moved to Kansas after it was over with, which was really shocking to me. I didn't know that they actually may have gotten married, but that's what his family says, because I think they were two teenagers who were kind of getting busy. And there was a white guy who got offended. So there's just a lot of little details like that that you don't learn in school, a lot of details that you're not going to catch in a lot of these documentaries and films that have been made. And I think that story needs to be told. Now, why did I bring Black Wall Street up when I started the conversation talking about student loans? Well, let me tell you this. So I'm walking through Black Wall Street and I'm looking at all the little, they have these little plaques to show you where all the black businesses were. And if you actually go to my Instagram is The Real Boyce Watkins. I showed the plaque where Madam C.J. Walker's business was. And Madam C.J. Walker's plaque, her business, is the where it's located is right where an expressway runs right over the location where her business used to be. Also, the expressway runs right over this space where they have this big, beautiful black-owned movie theater right there in the community. And in case you don't know, when they built the freeway system, the highway system, they used the highway system in what they call eminent domain to take the property away from black people, to dismantle the black neighborhoods. The white neighborhoods, white communities, white folks did not want the expressways going through their communities, but what they did strategically all throughout the United States, Detroit, St. Louis, Tulsa, they ran the freeways right through the black neighborhoods. So they literally ran the freeway right over Madam C.J. Walker's business. They ran it right over where they had this big black movie theater. So I'm looking at the Madam C.J. Walker plaque and all the other plaques that are there for these businesses that are not here anymore. And one thing that he mentioned that was really interesting was he said, yeah, the University of Tulsa bought all this land over here. They bought all this land over there. And the University of Tulsa is the Tulsa Historical Society or whatever. They own all of this footage and all this this archive data from Black Wall Street that they won't really share with anybody or let anybody have access to in a meaningful way. And basically, it made me think about student loans. And I whispered to my sister, I said, Tulsa, the University of Tulsa is able to go out and basically take all the money, the excess cash that these universities have from student loan debt. And they're going out all throughout the country and buying black neighborhoods, including Black Wall Street. This is just one of 100 different places I've seen where universities, because they've been so flush with cash, they have literally become the Pablo Escobars of the American economy. If you remember, Pablo Escobar's problem was that he had too much money. He was a big dope dealer. He had too much money and he had to stack it up in these stash houses and the money was stacked to the ceiling. He didn't know where to put the money. The rats would eat $2 billion a year of his money because he had so much of it. So the universities have become the Pablo Escobars of the American economy because they've saddled so many people with student loan debt and continuously jacked up the price of tuition beyond the rate of inflation. Beyond the rate of inflation, they've been able to accumulate massive excess resources. Well, a lot of these universities are nonprofit organizations, which means that they are required to spend all that money. Well, where do you think they're spending all this money? They're doing these massive land grabs where they're buying tons and tons of land all around the university. Well, many of these universities are surrounded by the hood. Yale is surrounded by black people. Syracuse University, when I was on the faculty there, they were surrounded by black people. And so what Syracuse was doing was strategically buying acres and entire city blocks of land that was previously owned by Black people. So this is happening even in Black Wall Street. A lot of the area that used to be Black Wall Street, the vast overwhelming majority of that area is owned by people who are not Black. And the University of Tulsa was able to take advantage of the student loan debt to take this extra money and go gentrify Black-owned property. So basically what they're doing, and this is why I want you to understand how economic warfare works. See, economics is warfare. This is why it's so important to understand it. I don't teach you economics every single day. I'm out here every single day, and I've been doing this for years. I don't do this every day because I want you to just be able to go out and buy a Lamborghini or a new pair of shoes or a Gucci belt. You can do all that if you want to, but that's childish stuff. That means nothing to me. That's just fulfilling the childhood need we all had to buy the stuff we couldn't afford. I teach you these things because if you don't understand economic warfare, then you will never understand how to obtain freedom in America. You must understand how economics is used to liberate you and also how economics can be used to enslave you. In fact, the whites in Black Wall Street engaged in massive economic warfare after Black Wall Street burned down. A lot of people don't know that they rebuilt a big chunk of Black Wall Street after it was done. But a lot of white-owned companies said, we're not going to sell to the Blacks. We're not anybody trying to rebuild in that area. We're not going to sell to them. That's economic warfare. And then also, they when they went and filed their insurance claims, almost all the claims were denied. Well, that's economic warfare. The only claim that was actually paid was to one guy who actually was so light-skinned that he could pass for white, and he checked white on his box, on his application, and they paid his claim because he was white. All the other Black businesses got their claims denied, millions and millions of dollars. And at that time, it was maybe about $2.7 million, I would guess, that in today's dollars, you're talking about probably over $100 million. I don't know. I don't know what $2.7 million in 1921 translates to today, but that's economic warfare. But here's the thing. The Black folks in Black Wall Street, they bought from each other. They created a culture of entrepreneurship. They created their property. They knew how to defend their property. Well, that's also a type of economic warfare that actually worked in our favor. So what I really want you to understand is that economics is competition. Economics is war. You cannot, it's like playing in a basketball game. You cannot win a basketball game if you keep giving the ball away to the other team. So ultimately, you've got to learn how to keep the ball to yourself, okay? So that was my two cents on this. Now, the last point I want to make on the student loan tip, let me just share this with you, is just in case you're wondering, if you go to my Instagram is The Real Boyce Watkins. I put a list of deadlines and dates for the student loan thing, where you can apply and when the forbearance, whatever they call it, where they're stopping you they're allowing you not to make payments, the deadline for that, but then also when, you know, how to make sure you get your $10,000 back. It's also going to be taxable in some states, untaxable in others. And right now the Republicans are looking for ways to sue to stop the student loan forgiveness. And that's unfortunate. I think it's kind of petty. I think it's ridiculous, especially given all the money that was thrown away with the PPP loans. And so ultimately, that's another funny thing that's going to work out one way or the other. But here's the other last piece on student loans that I want you to understand is how student loans link into not just our aggregate Black wealth competition or our Black wealth journey, but also in your specific Black wealth journey. I was listening to an analysis by an editor at Bloomberg, and everything he said was stuff that I agree with. These are things I've been feeling for probably about 15 years now. And I think 15 years ago, I had literally been teaching college students for about 12 years. So 15 years ago, I'd been more than a decade in this game in terms of experience with universities and teaching. 15 years ago, I was actually at Syracuse. And I started to realize some of the things that he mentioned in this interview. And what he did was he did a good job of explaining not just that universities have allowed the student loan debt crisis to fuel massive tuition increases. They've increased the price of tuition at rates that just are clearly unacceptable. But also, the college degree is not giving the bang for its buck that it used to be. It's become, for many people, for at least half of all Black college students, it's become a bad investment. A four-year degree for half of all Black college students is a bad investment. Now, I want to make that clear. This is not saying that college is always a bad investment. I'm not saying that at all. College is fun. College, you can learn a lot. You go to college, you get a degree in engineering, or you become a dentist. You're going to make money off that. It's going to take a lot of work. But if you like teeth, or you want to be a medical doctor, if you like blood and cutting people open and all that, that's fine. I wouldn't do it just for the money. And the reason I wouldn't do it just for the money is because if you ask me which is harder, I don't know, you answer to me, you give me an answer to this question. Which do you think is harder? Spending 8 years in medical school after you do your 4 years in college, or however many years you got to do, so you can make, say, $500,000 as a surgeon? Or is it easier to just spend maybe a year or two intensely learning how to be a great entrepreneur, so that maybe you find that one product that sells for $20, you're selling 3,000 units a month. Next thing you know, you're making $700,000 a year. Which is easier? Do you think that going to school for 10 years is easier than becoming an entrepreneur and intensely studying for a couple of years? I would say that if I could do it over again, I'm glad I have my PhD. I mean, it really helps me a lot. I'm able to analyze and break down a lot of things because my brain has been just super stretched and tested for so many years. But man, if I could do it over again, I probably wouldn't have gotten a doctorate. I would have done something similar to what I'm actually observing here in Tulsa. In Tulsa, my brother actually does work out here with a lot of venture capital funds, stuff like that. And they've got things like this incubator called TechStars. You may have heard of it, maybe not. But what they've done is they've gotten these really smart people. Many of them are black. In fact, I bumped into a lot of them. Some of them actually came through the Black Business School. I didn't know that. They just came up and started talking to me. And what they're doing is they're training them on how to run these amazing businesses and how to scale them. And most of the people that are coming through TechStars are, if they're not millionaires already, they're going to be millionaires soon. In fact, most of them are probably in their 20s or early 30s, and most of them have already made over $1 million. And many of them are going to become billion-dollar unicorns. Their companies will anyway, or they're going to, or maybe their company will be worth 100 million or something like that. And I was really impressed by that because I said, here you're getting not just formal education, but you're getting actual skill that translates into something that you truly value. So what I would encourage you to consider is what the Bloomberg editor was saying in his interview, which I agree with 100%, as he said that a 4-year degree isn't the only way to get what you need to move forward. It's really all about obtaining the skill necessary to do whatever you want to do. So there's a young guy I know who didn't enjoy being an engineering student in college. And what I did was I showed him that there are literally online universities that take less than a year to go through that are designed by companies like Apple and Google and backed by these tech companies, Microsoft, et cetera, because they're like, look, we just want to show you what you need to know so you can come work for us next year. And these options, I think, are just as good as going to a 4-year university. And also, you're not saddled with all that student loan debt. So I would make sure, if you're raising kids, focus on skills. Make sure they have skills, not just the degree. Because when I was teaching on college campuses, I saw a lot of students graduating with a degree, but having no skills. And I don't care who you are, if you got a degree and you walk up in my office, and if I hire a lot of people, I hire people all the time, I hire lots of young people. And if you can't show me a skill, you're not going to get the job. Now, you might show me, now, if you can probably get away with not showing me a degree. I don't even ask if you have a degree. I tell you what my specific problem is. And if you have the skill to solve that problem, then, excuse me, and you can prove it to me, then I will hire you to solve that problem. I don't care if some university, tap you on the forehead and gave you a piece of paper. That doesn't mean a whole lot to me. It doesn't mean that it means nothing. It just means it doesn't solve my problem. Do you understand? Okay, so teach that to your kids so that they can avoid these student loans, which are a huge deterrent to the ability to build black wealth. Many of our best and brightest, most educated black people are going to die with a negative net worth. That is not progress. Now, if you are in that category, don't be embarrassed. Don't feel sad. Don't beat yourself up. Some things you might want to do to flip the script a little bit is I really am a big fan of different forms of life insurance, whether you're talking about a term, even a term life policy, which ends at 30 years from now. But at the same time, that means during those 30 years, if you die, then there will be somebody that will have a positive net worth because you existed. I think that's a great way to leave some wealth. And then reason term is not so terrible is because your term policy price is going to be lower than a whole life policy. But after 30 years, by that time, you'll have had time to accumulate some wealth. You'll have some stocks, maybe have some real estate, some things like that. You could put them in a trust, pass them down, either low tax or no tax, depending on the situation. So ultimately, I think a good death plan, For all of us, I wouldn't call it a death plan. Let's call it a transition plan, because death sounds so grim. But that transition plan is really critical. So make sure you have a game plan, because again, this is a war, and we have to make sure that the other soldiers in this war are going to be prepared. The soldiers in the next generation of this war are going to be our children and grandchildren. I want to make sure that none of my kids are fit for slavery. None of my kids are fit for slavery. To me, fit for slavery means that you are vulnerable, where somebody can use something as simple as money. They can dangle a couple of dollars over your head and get you to do whatever you want. I don't want my daughters in that position, because I know what that can do to their self-esteem. I know what that can do to their, you know, to their happiness level. I know what that can do to their stress level. I don't want my daughters to be struggling single moms who got to go sleep with some guy just so they can get $200 toward the rent. That's not going to be their narrative. And I also don't want my son. I'm his bonus dad. He has a dad. He has another dad. He's lucky. He has two dads. And we coordinate on making sure that he's prepared for the future. And I don't want my son to be in a position where he has to go and become somebody's slave because nobody prepared anything for him. So you got to change that culture, change that narrative. Study O.W. Gurley. Go teach that to your kids. Don't wait for the school system to do it. We have to do it ourselves. Okay. All right. Now, by the way, I have to mention to you guys something that I mentioned it a lot, but I have to mention it, you know, every chance I get to make sure you know. There are lots of fake Boyce Watkins accounts out there where they literally will send you messages, and they will send you a direct message and say, inbox me, send me an inbox or whatever. And some people think that it's me. So they inbox the person. The person then eventually scams them out of some, you know, money or whatever. So just watch out for that. And if you see an account like that, if you could, please make sure that you report that account. That's really important to do. I just want to make sure nobody gets harmed by this kind of thing. All right. So what I'm going to do is answer some of your questions. Some of the questions were left last week. If you log in at the blackstockmarketprogram.com, you can actually find the form where you can leave the questions for me. And I'm going to start with Sika. Sika asks, she says, I've opened an E-Trade account for my three minor kids. What's the best asset to put this money into to serve as a savings account as it compounds? Okay. So Sika, what I would do, honestly, is I would like not even overthink it. I would literally, especially now is a great time for you and your children to be able to really take advantage of the stock market. The stock market, the prices have dropped tremendously. I think that a consistent investing plan for your kids is the best gift you can offer them. And so what I would do, Sika, is maybe look into something like some sort of maybe an S&P 500 index fund. Something really simple that you can plop your money into, where your children own a piece of the strongest companies in America. So what you look for, there's one with the ticker symbol VOO, VOO. This is from Vanguard. Now, this is not me endorsing Vanguard, but I know Vanguard is good. They're going to protect your money. And so Vanguard has a form has a fund, VOO is the ticker, where you could literally do something really basic. You could do the $5 a day investing plan that I showed you guys. If you go to blackmoneyminute.com, the ebook is there free. Also, if you log into blackstockmarketprogram.com, I put it in there too. And basically, if you're doing something like $5, you know, $20 a week, $40 a week, $100 a week, whatever you can afford, you just have that money automatically dropped in there. And the big promise I want you to make to yourself is that I will not sell these assets ever. I will not sell these assets ever. All I'll do is when the kids get old enough and they've shown maturity, I'm thinking like 28 to 30 is a good age. I think 25 is a little too young, but maybe you're lucky. Maybe your kids are mature. I would transfer some of those assets to them on an as needed basis when they're 28, you know, to 30 years old. So that's when they're making critical decisions in their lives. That's when they're trying to buy their first house. That's when they're trying to avoid student loan debt. That's when they're trying to maybe get married or stuff like that. And you will be amazed at how much money that grows into if you're consistently doing that, say, $50 to $100 a week, and you're just dropping it in there and not even thinking about it. Just set it and forget it. And in fact, here's another myth. A lot of people believe that there has to be an exit point when it comes to investing. They believe that there has to be a point where you sell the stock that you buy. No, there doesn't. No, there doesn't. There does not have to be any point where you sell anything. You don't have to sell nothing. Remember, what is a rich person? What makes a person rich? How do you know the difference between a rich person and a poor person? I want you to process that for a minute. How do you know the difference? If I tell you somebody's rich, think about it. What would I might say next? I might say, Oh, well, you know, he owns a couple of oil wells and he owns 25 dry cleaners all throughout the city. You'll be like, oh, yeah, okay, I get it. Yeah, oh, wow, he's rich. Or if I say, oh, yeah, she's really wealthy. What, she owns, 10 hair salons and 20 rental properties all throughout, all throughout the state. You'd be like, oh, I get it. That makes sense that she's rich. So what's the common denominator here? Eric, you have it right. It's accumulated assets. It's what they own. It's what they control. So think about this. What if that lady who owned the five hair salons and 20 rental properties just sold everything? Now, sure, she'd have a bunch of cash, but if she sold everything and then spent the money, well, she wouldn't be rich anymore. So rich people, all rich people are people who've gotten really good at accumulating stuff, right? So, like they kind of have a hoarder kind of approach to life. They just accumulate things, like you go in my bedroom, I hoard stuff, I save stuff, right? And also I hoard stocks. I love every time I get extra money, I don't buy shoes or things that are going to perish. I buy shares of stock. I want to be invested in every good company I can possibly find anywhere on the planet. I love to invest. I'm addicted to it. I hate using the word addiction. My wife is an addiction specialist, so she probably qualified that term. But I love it. I just love get when I get income, and I love taking that income and translating that into some form of ownership, because what that does, and this is where understanding your financial personality is really important. And by the way, if you're in the Prime program, Dr. Alicia is going to be doing another financial therapy session on Sunday. You can log into drboyceprime.com and get access. But if you but one of the things about the program is she's actually going to show everyone this week a little bit more about how to determine your financial personality and really how to understand your emotional connection to money. So what I found when I understood my financial personality was that I love to spend money. I got that from when I was a little kid. I would get money, it would burn a hole in my pocket, and I would just spend it. And so when I became more of an investor, what I learned was that spending money was the thing that gave me comfort, satisfaction. I don't know, like a type of retail therapy. That's a real thing. But I really didn't need to spend it on any particular thing. It didn't matter what I spent the money on. So what I did was I said, okay, instead of spending money on things that are silly and not going to add value, I'm going to spend money on things that are going to appreciate in value. So now instead of spending money on clothes or shoes or going out to eat, I'll spend money on shares of stock. I love to buy shares of stock. I love to buy a new piece of real estate. I love accumulating things. Right. So you want to have that sort of mindset. If you are an accumulator, if you are an economic hoarder, so to speak, not to use the term with a negative connotation, but if you like to hoard things and that's what you do on a regular basis, then eventually you'll be rich too, because you'll just have lots of stuff. That's how we know the difference between rich people and poor people. It's just how much stuff they have. So a lot of wealthy families, they're not selling nothing. They don't no, nothing. A lot of None of their stuff is for sale. You say, well, can I buy that from you? And they'd be like, well, why would I sell that house to you? It's going to be worth another $100,000 in 2 or 3 years. Why would I give that to you? It's been in my family since 1920. Why would I sell that to you? The only time they would sell that to you is if they are economically distressed. That's the only time they would sell it. Is, the Vanderbilts have lost their entire fortune and they're trying to hold on. So they start selling assets. There's a great documentary I watched with my wife about the newspaper mogul. What was his name? William Randolph Hearst. He's a big old fat racist white man. But I don't care. The racism doesn't, honestly, that stuff doesn't offend me. I just watch out for it and I overcome it. But it doesn't. I don't care what you think. It's your right to think what you want. I can take care of myself, so I don't need you to like me. I just need you to get out of my way. So, but anyway, so William Randolph Hearst was this guy who controlled so many of the newspapers all throughout the country. He had a lot of wealth and a lot of power. And one of the things that he did, he made the mistake in his business of getting a little bit too cocky and overexpanding. And so what happens when you overexpand your business is you can run into cash flow shortages. And he ran into a cash flow shortage, so he needed money badly. So he went through the humiliating process of having to liquidate all the stuff that he had. I mean, this guy was you talk about a hoarder. This guy had a gigantic mansion full of all these really expensive European artifacts he had bought after World War II. Now, where did he get those artifacts? Well, he got them cheap. He got them on the cheap in Europe because after World War II, the Europeans were the ones who were financially distressed. So because they were financially distressed, you have these royal families who want to maintain their image. This is why images are very dangerous. You want to don't I would be careful about getting in the habit of trying to impress people that don't matter. But the royal family or this wealthy family doesn't want to look bad, so they start selling all their priceless artifacts. And they're selling them super cheap because they need the cash. So he was able to take advantage of other people's distress and buy these assets super cheap. And then when he became distressed, people were able to come back behind him and buy his assets super cheap. And so ultimately, one of the things that you should get from this is twofold. One, rich people just tend to be hoarders and they just own things and they just keep them and they hold them for as long as they can. And then two, when you are building your empire, your economic empire, you always want to make sure that there's plenty of liquidity. You always want to make sure that you're financially prepared to pay the bills and you don't overexpand yourself. Because when you overextend yourself, when you're over leveraging into the ground, or you make a good real estate deal and somebody says, well, no, take the equity out, go buy another property, get another property, get another property. Well, if the values of those properties start dropping and suddenly the bank is telling you, hey, you're gonna have to come up with some cash to maintain your control over all these assets, you want to be ready for that. Okay, do you understand? So that's kind of the game. So the accumulation process. There was a Wall Street Journal article where they basically explained what rich people do. They buy, borrow, and die. That was their strategy. They said that what they'll do is they accumulate a bunch of assets on top of whatever they had when they were young, whatever their parents left them. So they become even richer because they just accumulate more stuff, and then they don't actually sell anything. Why, again, why would you sell an appreciating asset? Why would you sell your future? You don't do that, right? So what they do is instead of selling the asset, they maintain control and ownership of the asset and they borrow against the asset. They borrow against it. So that helps them maintain whatever lifestyle they want to maintain. And then when they die, they're able to pass these assets on to their children, and their children are pretty much able to take control of these assets tax-free. In certain situations, they put them in a trust or whatever the case may be, and they just pass it on to their kids. And they just sort of pass the ball. So a lot of wealth in America is locked up wealth. It's locked up, and the only time it gets unlocked is when you have an opportunity to get them to kind of come outside, so to speak, meaning that you find a moment of vulnerability. This is why poor economic conditions, a lot of people think that during a recession or a depression that it's just bad for everybody. No, it is a great opportunity for the people that know how to play economic warfare. If you are in a position to where you've been protecting your cash and getting ready for a downturn, you're able to go through and acquire distressed assets at a bargain basement price. I was just watching, anybody else watch House of the Dragon? There's a show on HBO called House of the Dragon, which is a prequel to Game of Thrones. Game of Thrones, my wife and I love it. We watched every episode all the way to the end. Now we watch House of the Dragon and we love that too. It's a great show. Anyway, in House of the Dragon, there was a part where there was this guy called the crab feeder, and he was a scary, ugly looking dude who was like killing everybody. And he took control of this little area, and they were trying to get rid of him because he was causing so many problems, so much havoc. Well, the problem they had, because and they had the big dragons that could just blow fire on you, but the problem was the crab feeder and all his soldiers would hide in the caves. Whenever they saw the dragons coming, they would just hide in the caves so the dragons couldn't get to him. So they said, we got to find a way to lure him out of the caves. So, long story short, they set a trap and they get the crab feeder, the bad guy, and all his troops to come out of the caves. Like hundreds of them all came out of the caves. And that's when the dragons all came in and blew fire and killed everybody, right? And so what's the moral of the story? What am I saying? Well, what's going on there, which reminds me of economic warfare, is that they were locked in, they were caved out, they were protected, they were safe. You know, they had their position, they were holding their position, they couldn't be touched. The minute they became vulnerable, that was when the opportunistic opposition stepped in and took them out, right? So the same thing is true when you talk about owning things like property. There are people that will sit on property, sit on land, and say, we're not selling, I'm not selling, I don't need to sell. Oh, it's not for sale. Well, what can we offer you? Well, we're not here to sell. So you know what the bank will do, or the corporation will do, or whoever will do, if they really are thinking in terms of economic warfare? They'll just sit there and just watch. They'll be like, oh, okay, she's 80 years old. How much longer is she? I heard that she's a little bit sick. Or we heard that their family is fighting over the assets, and you know, and the mother passed it down to the kids, and the kids are all fighting each other. Maybe we can take advantage of that. Or we heard that they're having financial problems and their money's tight right now, so maybe we could take advantage of that. Do you understand? They're waiting for you to come outside. You know, you buy something, you own it, you sit on it, and that's where you are in, you are the strongest. Just like House of the Dragon, when that guy was just sitting and holding his position, holding his asset, which was his security, he was holding that territory and just sitting still, they couldn't touch him. But the minute he allowed himself to become vulnerable, that was when they swooped in and killed everybody. So ultimately for Black people, this is why, one of the reasons why your wealth disappears so quickly. Your wealth disappears very quickly because you are always in a vulnerable state. You're always, not all of you, not you. I'm talking about generally speaking. I'm talking about those that really are in the struggle in a horrible way. There's always sort of this very clumsy economic stumbling that occurs where you're kind of figuring it out as you go along. You know, you're always, if you're always in survival mode, then you can't possibly be in prosperity mode. There's always an emergency. There's always a problem. There's always a vulnerability. Somebody's always fighting over something. There's always a desperate need for money. And when you are in those situations where you're vulnerable and desperate, that's when you start losing the game of economic warfare. So I would just say to you, if you really want to be smart, and I hit on some of these topics, in case I didn't mention to you guys, my next book coming out is called The 10 Commandments of Black Economic Power. One of the things I would tell you is that if you really want your family to be wealthy, strong, and prosperous for many generations to come, make sure you have a strategy. Make sure that you build a culture around economic discipline. Make sure that you have that your economic soldiers are as well-trained as possible. And make sure that they understand the importance of working together, maintaining peace, coordinating their actions. And then it's going to be very difficult for anybody to kind of penetrate your kingdom. Yeah, I do think that's appropriate to think of life in that way. So don't be vulnerable. That's the point. All right, so let me hop in and answer a couple more questions that you guys submitted in advance. I see Quade says, let's see here. I purchased the course, and after purchasing it, said I could have gotten the stock market weekend for 68, but no option. Okay, so you, Quade, would like to sign up for the Black Stock Market Weekend. Okay, all right, great. So what I did, Quade, was I grabbed a link that gives you a big discount that takes the price down from $249 to $68. And I'm going to put that link inside the chat. And also, if you ever have a question like that or any issue like that, you guys are always welcome to reach out to support@theblackbusinessschool.com. And if you want to, if you, anybody's interested and they want to go take a look and see what's there, you can also go to thedrboycemethod.com, thedrboycemethod.com. And that's where I put together an 11-step method that I use to select the stocks that I pick. And that was basically the Black Stock Market Weekend. I spent the whole weekend taking you guys through 11 steps. At some point in the next year, I'll do another one live. But if you want to see the recording of the last one, you can click on that link and get a discount. So it's thedrboycemethod.com if you want to take a look. But those of you that are in the Zoom, that's the coupon code you can use to get the discount that Quay's referring to. All right, so let's see here. Kareem says, I've invested $2,000 between SWP at PPX and SCHG, Google, and Microsoft. Current allocation, okay. All right. For a 20-year time horizon, should I choose a fund like XLY or XLK to replace Google and Microsoft? Okay, well, one thing I'm going to say is I'm not really going to tell you, you know, what and then not selling might be a good route to go. Sharif Gamble says, I joined the recurring income course. The question is there an order in which I should start the courses? I would say, Sharif, that if you joined the passive recurring income program, drboyceprime.com, that's the URL, drboyceprime.com. If you did join, what I would do is start with, depending on what you want to know, but I would start with the introduction to investing with stock options. That way you can learn the basics of stock options. You can learn calls and puts. You can learn sort of how options work. And then you can move into the lectures that involve selling the options, which is where the passive recurring income component of the class comes from. That's the part that shows you how to generate income. I think selling stock options right now is a good way to go, just because the market is so bearish and so ugly. Even if it's bullish, people feel like it's eventually going to get bearish again. So so the thing is that selling is always a bearish move. That's what you do when you think prices are going to go down, but you don't want to necessarily always sell your stock. But I sell the options. That way I can maintain ownership of the stock, but still generate some sort of income. So the URL, if you want to log in and get access to everything, is drboyceprime.com. So feel free to go take a look. All right, so let's see here. I see a question that says, any discount with actual tickets for events? Are you talking about the convention, All Black National Convention? If you go to allblacknationalconvention.com, try to use the discount code word book club, all one word, and that should give you a discount. So go to allblacknationalconvention.com, and if you use the discount code book club, that should take a percentage off the price. I'm checking to see if it works and see if I can enter the code while I'm talking to you. Here we go. Enter promo code. Yeah, when you log in, when you click on tickets at the top left, there's something that says promo code or enter promo code. So you can type in book club. Let me see if I can apply it. And does it take off? Yes. If you type in book club, it'll drop your general admission ticket price from $299 to $209, or your VIP pass price from $699 to $489. And that's for the whole weekend. Actually, it drops the prices of every single ticket, the kids tickets, the senior citizens ticket, military discount tickets, etc. So feel free to just go in and use the code word book club and get a discount. It's allblacknationalconvention.com. Okay, the next question. Okay, let's see here. I'm looking at Kim Hitchcock says, need link to volunteer, tried to register, it didn't work. You're talking about the volunteer form? Did you go to boycewatkins.com to click on the volunteer link? Let me check. I'm going to show you guys where the link is to volunteer. So let me screen share. So if you go to boycewatkins.com, let me show you my site. And you go down here on my page and you type in volunteer application. You click on that. There should be a form right here. Do you all see it on the screen? Everybody inside the Zoom should see it. And so if you want to fill it out, you just hit next and you can go in here and you got to put in all, you got to fill out some information. And so being a volunteer is not something where we're just taking any and everybody as a volunteer. We need people to apply and to show where they can add value. And there's a training process because we need to make sure our volunteers are ready. The email sent this morning does not work. You can't complete the form through the email sent. Let me see here. I recommend resending the email with updated links. Yeah, I will. I'm surprised by that. Thank you for telling me that. Yeah, so I'll just send it out again. So thank you for telling me that. I appreciate that information. But yeah, or for now, you can go to boycewatkins.com. You can find it there too. Yeah, so sorry about that. I normally test my links when I email things out. So I wonder if something happened where the link went bad. Okay, now I'm feeling a little bit awkward. Sorry, so sorry for that. All right, so let's see. If you purchase a cover call and it doesn't hit the strike price, if you have a question about options, I prefer to leave that for the options class. The Prime program is going to meet this Thursday at 2:00. So log in at drboyceprime.com and you should be able to find the information there. Now, if you did the boot camp, that's not the same as the program we're in now. The boot camp is over. All that material is yours for life. It's just there. It's not going to change at all, right? No new sessions, no nothing. But if you decided to stick around and you wanted to do the Prime program, you can log in at drboyceprime.com. There is a link there that gives you the Zoom information for Thursday at 2 p.m. Eastern. That's when we're going to have our next class meeting. And I've also sent you out an email, and I'll also send you all text messages to give you updates. Dennis, I watched the documentary Inside Job and wondered if the companies I own merge or gets bought, what happens to the stock? It depends on the situation, Dennis. There's so many different ways mergers can be worked out. But generally, it all typically makes sense. And mergers are scenarios where remember, as a shareholder, you're the most important party in that whole process. So when companies merge, they have to make sure the shareholders approve it, and they have to make sure the shareholders are good. And the only reason they're going to approve it is if they're good. So if you own stock in a company and the company merges, then it's going to be good for you. It's all going to work out. Now, one of you asked about the whole thing with the CEO or the CFO of Bed Bath & Beyond. In case you don't know, Bed Bath & Beyond is a meme stock that's had a lot of interesting action lately. I bought shares mainly so I could sell the options because the option prices were ridiculously high. Well, the CFO of Bed Bath & Beyond jumped off a building and killed himself a couple of days ago. And at the same time, he was in the middle of an investigation or being sued for price manipulation of the stock. I felt that there was manipulation. I did a video about that where I was specifically focused on a guy named Ryan Cohen, who I feel I felt like he might have done a pump and dump on this stock where he pushed the price up. And then when the price went really high, because what happens is all these meme stock traders started believing in Ryan Cohen, and they were buying stocks that he would tell them. So he would announce that he was buying something, and everybody else would buy it because he bought it, which is kind of crazy because what it does then is it creates an unfair opportunity for him to profit off of people just following him. So then the other crazy thing that he did was he bought about $1 million of what they call deep out of the money call options, long-term deep out of the money call options. And so basically, like, so the stock's trading at 20 or whatever, right? And he buys a call option that has a strike price of like 80, and they're like 8 months out into the future. So here's what that is. Here's what that says, right? Because remember, he's an insider to the company. He's an influential guy. So people are paying attention to what he does. People are following him. So him buying that deep out of the money long-term call option, that's like a guy coming to a woman's house and saying, "Hey, babe, I love you. I want to have kids with you. I want to be with you forever. In fact, I just bought," and he dangles some keys and says, "These are keys to our new house that I just bought on a 30-year contract because I love you that much," right? If a man does something like that, which I'm sorry if it triggers anybody, because if you've been lied to before, I'm so sorry. Join the club. I've been lied to also. If someone does something like that, you're thinking, okay, they're serious. They're making a long-term commitment. Like this is the real deal. So then what happens is you start to reciprocate. You start making equally ambitious commitments to the relationship because you're thinking, oh, they're in it with both feet. So I'm going to jump in it with them because I want to be that ride or die girlfriend or wife or whatever. Right. And then you find out later that it was all a hoax, and it's a terrible crime. People should be able to prosecute for stuff like that. In fact, I had a relative who used to do stuff like that to people, and it made me really sad. He would just say whatever the woman wanted to hear, and they'd get pregnant in 3 or 4 weeks, then they'd get married 6 weeks later, and he would be the dream man until she started finding out what he really was all about. And he just did this process over and over again. That's why you got to research people before you invest in them. Just like you research your stocks, you got to research the human beings that come in your life, because they can either be assets or they can be asses. So you got to make sure they're assets and not asses. But anyway, long story short, that's what Ryan Cohen did to the meme stock investors. He made them think that the stock was going to fly to the moon, that he's going to be in it for the long haul, that he's going to make this company great again, and everything's going to be wonderful. I believe that was all a sham. In fact, by the way, can you guys still hear me? Give me a yes. Give me a yes in the chat if you can hear me, okay? Let me know you can hear me because I want to make sure I'm coming through okay. I'm not sure my audio. Okay, thank you, Tara and Janet. I appreciate that. Okay, so what happened? So that's what led me to say, wait a minute, this guy, I think he might have manipulated the stock. Like, this is crazy. And I did a video about it, but I didn't hear anybody else talking about it. And so a few days later, I saw the investigation. There's been a class action lawsuit filed against him as well as that CFO. And that was when the suicide took place, unfortunately. And so that's what it is. It's sad, but and this is what happens. This is why you got to be careful when you play in the world of meme stocks. If you play in the world of meme stocks, just be ready for anything. Because what's happened is that there's just this really bad market where there's not good transparency, the regulations are iffy, there's a lot of market manipulation. There are whales in these meme stock markets that are profiting off of people's lack of information or ignorance. And you don't want to be caught in the crossfire of that. So be really careful if you invest with meme stocks. Let's see. How did Inez is asking, spell his name. You talking about O.W. Gurley? Yeah, I think it's G-U-R-L-E-Y, O.W. Gurley. Yeah, if you just type it into Google, Google should be able to find it. But look up this guy. Teach your kids about him. He's every bit as important as any white man you've ever learned about in school. And you learn about lots of white men, so you need to learn about some of the great black men and great black women, too. Let's see, Cedric, can we do a class on life insurance? Yeah, we can. And I know somebody who could teach that class, so I'm going to get on that, actually. Actually, you know what? I'm going to talk to my insurance agent today. And I think I'm going to ask her. We already talked about it a little bit, but I'm going to follow up with her. And if I can't get her, I'll find somebody else. I know a lot of great insurance people. Lydia, how do you do the math with savings bonds? The current interest rate is 9.62% for 6 months at $1,000 invested, assume 5 years. Okay. So what you would do is you would add one to your interest rate. So if your interest rate, which 9% is a pretty high amount for a 6 month period, so I'd be real